The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. Last week's program was all about mobile. This week, the podcast team will be looking at the latest web news, from the battle between corporations and internet rights activists for net neutrality to social activism made possible through online tools. Joining me to discuss these stories and more are The Guardian's digital media correspondent Jemima Kish, paid contents Robert Andrews, and Mendeley's CEO and co-founder Victor Hennig. Welcome to you all.
Hello.
Well, there's been a lot of web news over the past week, and we aim to give you the details on our picks of the main stories. Victor will be talking us through his collaboration tool for academics. We'll dish the dirt on Google Wave, and we'll find out why Facebook users have formed a union. Keep listening for the next 30 minutes of the best technology news on the web from Tech Weekly. Google and U.S. internet service provider Verizon have nailed down a closed-door seven-point proposal to the U.S. FCC that may have serious implications for the neutrality of the web. Net neutrality activists argue that a corporate deal with the service provider, effectively the people who run the pipes of the web, would disrupt the equilibrium that currently reigns, in which ISPs have no control over the content that we access when we're online. Now, campaigners fear that better services for cash could create a tiered internet, inaccessible to startups or web companies in developing countries. It would ultimately disadvantage people who can't pay for better services. Furthermore, Verizon is one of the biggest wireless operators in the USA, and the proposal that it and Google have brokered effectively excuses wireless internet providers from the net neutrality clauses it outlines. Jemima, there are 7 points that the search engine and that the ISP have detailed. What are the key ones and which ones are the most controversial?
God, you get two schools of thought with the net neutrality debate. You get people that are really geeky and obsessive about it, and then you get people who just think, what the hell is that? Sounds really boring. So I'll spare you the boring detail. Essentially, this deal would propose that providers can't block access to any legal services, can't discriminate against any traffic that might be a competitor or a rival, and can manage their traffic. Those are some of the main points. So they would be able to prioritise certain traffic at certain times of day, which ISPs already do to some extent. A very significant one is that they can add additional online services. And this is quite peculiar because Google has said they're very pro net neutrality, and yet this clause seems to me to be completely contradicting that, because Verizon have already said that they used as an example 3D, so they could build an entire new layer of internet over the existing service that people would pay extra for that would be a 3D service. So it's very confusing and very contradictory, I think.
Well, in addition, I believe there are some clauses that effectively say for wireless operators that none of this is actually relevant for them. Can you talk a little bit about what the implications are for that?
Well, this is the second really big point about this, that all of these points, none of these apply to wireless networks, basically, apart from the point about you have to be transparent about the service that you're providing and where there are restrictions within that. And Verizon is a massive wireless company in the States, as you said. And in the future, who's to say that there would be any wired networks left?
Of course, because so often we're simply accessing the web through our smartphones.
Ultimately. Exactly, exactly. And the smartphone is the computer of the future. I mean, desktops will evaporate in whatever form. So in many ways, this is contradictory and almost quite meaningless, because it summarizes an internet that is disappearing.
But ultimately, isn't this a business arrangement? Isn't this, you know, this is Google talking with Verizon. This is web developers talking with the pipe overseers. How will this affect us as users of the World Wide Web?
Everyone is looking to the States for leadership in this area. And Ofcom is already looking at net neutrality. In the UK, ISPs are already proposing that the BBC would pay to have its video content delivered, because it's a disproportionate volume of the UK's web traffic. And that would make for a very different experience for UK web users, I think.
And in terms of this arrangement between Google and Verizon, Robert, do you think that this is going to trickle down to us, the rest of the world?
Well, I think I'm in the what's the big deal camp. I think, you know, we're moving from, the internet is evolving from a network that distributed mostly text content and some small web pages to one, as Jemima said, that's going to be distributing a lot of video content, not just to your desktop web browser, but when we're all plugging broadband cables into the back of our TV, that's going to place a huge burden on the network. And I think it's fair enough for ISPs to say we need to find a way to manage this. When you consider the mobile web in particular, that's really heading for a crunch. We all know the problems O2 has had keeping its network up over the last couple of years, thanks to iPhone users. The networks are currently trying to invest in more capacity, but I think they do have to be looking at ways to manage what they have. And as long as most people aren't missing out, I think it's fair enough to find a way to accommodate these new types of traffic on top of that.
Well, what about in developing countries? Because if we're talking about, so much of things like banking happens in the continent of Africa, for example, that's widely celebrated. So that's a wireless phenomenon, a wireless net phenomenon. In addition, web developers from developing countries may not have the finances to bump themselves up. How might this affect this idea of digital divide and potentially even focus web development in places like the US and the UK?
Well, I think to what extent are the second tier users of the network really going to be missing out? Isn't this more a case of top tier companies wanting to pay a little bit to guarantee delivery? I think the majority of people, then maybe 99% of users of the network beneath that, probably not going to be missing out terribly.
We will be looking at having something like the kind of Virgin Media package choice you have today, where, you know, you choose which bits you want. Who knows how many different levels of internet access there would be. And so you are going to have money as a consumer to make the most of the internet.
Victor, the academic community has already created its own internet in many ways behind a paywall, because, you know, often you find that for research, you've got to pay money in order to have access to this kind of content. How do you think that a Google-Verizon deal would create another circle of closed content, or do you think it would?
Well, I think it would be terrible to circumvent net neutrality, because the paywall that you're referring to is for content that's already published. But I think video isn't the only application that needs a lot of bandwidth. So, I mean, us and many people in the research community have been trying to get researchers to share more raw data. And those can be huge data sets, terabytes, like genome data, planetary data. So a lot of this data needs to be shared. And often I think these experiments also rely on real-time exchange of data. So if then ISPs start managing the packets and the packets simply don't arrive because somebody else paid money to get their packets there first, I think nobody knows where this is going to go.
Well, clearly there is a lot of debate even in this room. And we'll be speaking with Desiree Milosevic, who's been on the board with ICANN and a special advisor on internet governance for the United Nations, in a forthcoming program. In other Google news, the search engine cum web app Megalith had to admit defeat in one of its services this week. Google Wave, promoted originally as the ultimate communication tool combining email, instant messaging, and real-time collaboration, was shut down because it wasn't adopted by enough people. Jemima, what was Wave?
It was a good idea, I think, is a way to summarise it. I mean, Google has so many projects and has a lot of failures because it creates loads of stuff. I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing. But essentially, this was a way of aggregating all your communications. So you'd start a wave, and that could combine a sort of Twitter-like message with perhaps a link to a document with an email thread, which is a great idea. And I think people weren't really ready for it at the moment. And at some point in the future, this idea is going to come up again, perhaps with a slightly better interface, and one that, I mean, Google obviously didn't want to link to external services any more than it had to, but it would really need to do this very well. I think this idea is going to come back.
Robert, wasn't any good?
Well, it was welcome experimentation, I think. I think it was an attempt to improve archaic old email by injecting some real-time goodness into it. It was an R&D experiment that got out of the lab. And, you know, if you want to make an omelette, you've got to break some eggs. But Google is such a large, high-profile company that it breaks a lot of its eggs in public, and they're really big eggs.
Well, what does this actually say, do you think, about this idea that what Google does a lot of is throw things at the wall, throw a lot of eggs at the wall effectively and see what sticks? Is this effective? Does it break this whole concept of agile development?
It points to the fact that a lot of Google's development and product development process can be a little bit haphazard. Google Wave actually had very little connection to its core business, which was search advertising. Wave should always have been integrated into Gmail, much like Google Buzz is, as controversial as it has been. It points to a disconnect, really, somewhere in Google's product development process. Something didn't quite click. And I think, you know, kudos to them for saying, stop, let's pull the plug and rethink.
Victor, academics should have jumped on this service, really. You know, this is like the ideal collaboration tool for them, isn't it? I mean, why didn't they? Is there something out there that's better?
Well, I mean, I know at least one academic who's not going to be happy because today Mendeley is launching the developer portal. And one of the apps that one person developed was actually a Mendeley plugin for Google Wave, because when Wave was introduced, a lot of academics fantasized that they could use it to collaboratively write papers. And the thing that was missing was a good way to get citations and looking up maybe related research in Wave. And I remember that last year at the Science Online conference, which we co-hosted with Nature at the Royal Institution, we had one of the first public demos of Wave. So it's actually less than a year ago, I think, that it launched. And everybody was so excited. And the demo visually was very appealing. And I could see that a lot of people might want to use it. But actually, once I tried, it just became kind of confusing and rather irritating to see people spell out their thoughts in slow motion. And academics, you know, being prone to thinking a lot anyway, that dragged on quite a bit. So maybe that was the reason.
I don't know what you're talking about. Thinking a bit. I have no earthly idea what you're talking about.
It's just rumors.
Certainly just rumors. I'd like to see a paper on that, actually. Well, we will watch Google's other services with bated breath to see which will succeed and which, this is my funny little joke, wait for it, will also wave goodbye to. Oh, I'm so amused. Finally, the beleaguered social network Facebook was unionized this week with the establishment of the Facebook Users Union, a group set up by freelance advertising creative Richard Buchanan. Richard joins us down the line. Welcome to the podcast, Richard. So why set up the Facebook Users Union?
I look at these services every day and I use them a lot, and I see that they're generating lots and lots of value, but they're being created by us and the value's being taken away to shareholders. And I just thought, well, it'd be an interesting experiment to see if we could maybe do something about getting some of the value back into a more positive situation for people that really need it, really.
Are you seeking to get actual cash money out of Mark Zuckerberg here?
Not really. I mean, it's something that crosses my mind. I know that probably won't ever happen.
It crosses my mind as well, I have to say.
The thing is, I think it's the concept, really. And I think people should really be aware of the fact that they are contributing to these services and they are generating value. And, you know, the value is being centralized and given away. I mean, these companies are, you know, operating like cooperatives, but paying themselves like private companies. And that's kind of quite unethical, really. And that's why I set it up, because I think, you know, 500 million people, you know, that's a lot of work, really.
And earlier this summer, we were writing about a project called Diaspora, which I know you're quite interested in, Richard. And their idea is to develop a system where people would kind of host their own personal information locally. And then when they choose to, they would share that with sites like social networking sites. But they still retain control of that. And if you think about associating a value with that, so you might charge Facebook, you know, even £1 or something a month to access your data. It's a completely different way of thinking about the value of our personal data and how businesses build that into their model, I think. It's more a concept than something that would actually happen, but it's an interesting thing to think about.
Facebook says that it's free. I think that they've redefined the word free to suit their own purposes. I mean, you know, we are paying with our own data. I mean, they're building models of us and we're giving them access to our everyday lives, and that's really valuable. I mean, advertisers really, really enjoy having access to that kind of level of detail, really, I think. So if we could charge for it, then why not? I mean, you know, but the idea would be to give the money to places that really need it, rather than, you know, because it's such a small amount of money, but when it's scaled up, you know, it becomes quite significant, I think.
Aren't people already aware that they that they are involved in a transaction with Facebook, that they are giving up this personal information? Do people not know that?
I think they probably do. I guess it's just when you take a look back, you take a step back and you look at the overall picture, you know, you begin to see a pattern emerging that, you know, that this data has an awful lot of value. I mean, Facebook says it will be free forever. So they're obviously quite confident that, you know, they can continue to use the information we're providing to generate revenue and possibly profits, I guess.
Richard, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is quite famous for doing what he thinks is right for the service, and damn to the rest of us, people will get used to it, by gum. And, you know, the newsfeed example is oft cited. He simply he pushed newsfeed up. People went, whoa, what happened last night? Found out what happened last night and what happened last night with all of their friends. Freaked out about it for a little while, and then now it's one of the most significant and oft replicated aspects of the service. So does the formation of the Facebook Users Union suggest that you do not have faith in Mark Zuckerberg's management technique?
Well, I don't know. I mean, is Mark Zuckerberg a benevolent dictator? I mean, you know, maybe. Obviously, we know that these services are often purchased by people that maybe don't have such benevolent intent. And the problem with Facebook for me is that the newsfeed and Twitter also is that they provide a transient access to the user, i.e. I provide what happened in that particular moment, but they create a sticky permanence for the system. So they can really, you know, mine the data and they can build very complicated models. I think that, you know, that's where the value lies. I mean, imagine if you use Facebook for another decade, you know, they're going to know an awful lot about you. And you know, that's really where Diaspora comes in, I guess. And the fact that they let you keep your data and let you keep control of your own data, so they say. You know, I think Mark Zuckerberg, yeah, he's doing a great thing, but I think it could be better. I guess, for me, if you look at the way Facebook is used, it's used for quite media-related stuff. But when it starts turning onto activist-style things and giving people the chance to make a positive impact, they generally take it, you know, especially with the Haiti thing and donations. I think people really want to use it for that, but they're not really given the opportunity to.
Finally, Richard, Facebook asked its users to sign a Bill of Rights last February 2009, because they effectively wanted to stave off any future criticism of their terms of service. But surely the fact that we would have all had to click accept and agree on this to maintain our relationship with Facebook makes the union moot. Does it not?
Terms and conditions are a funny thing, because, you know, they're not really designed to be read by an average person. They're quite complicated and there's lots and lots of them, which obviously there has to be for legal reasons. I mean, I don't know, maybe, I mean, one of the things I would really like to see is if Facebook would enable you to actually remove your content from their system. I think that's fair. If that's, you know, the Bill of Rights is that they get to keep your content forever and ever and they can do whatever they want with it. Well, I don't think the average person would probably have signed that if they'd have actually been more aware. So I don't know, maybe the union in that respect is a little bit mute, but the concept itself still stands. And, you know, I personally believe that if another social network came along in 2 or 3 years' time, it would possibly consider incorporating the profit share model into its business, because I think it would create a more benevolent system, and I think people would react quite positively to that. So maybe not for Facebook, but definitely if the concept is raised, it could be incorporated into future social networking sites.
Very interesting idea. Well, thank you very much, Richard, for joining us. And if you'd like to stand up for Facebook users' rights, then join the Facebook Users Union and make your voice heard. Read up on all these stories as they unfold and more from the Guardian's technology team at guardian.co.uk/technology. Academic research has always been a collaborative process, and scholars have often been the first users of internet services. Yes, because we are early adopters. Indeed, the first internet was established between 3 universities in the USA, and so it comes as no surprise that collaborative tools remain at the core of modern academics' web use. Mendeley is the latest in this library, a service developed by CEO and co-founder Victor Hennig, who has been with us throughout the entire program, which allows researchers the ability to share research documents, collaborate on papers, and tag interesting resources for people with similar interests. It recently won the Future Technologies Pitching Contest at the Guardian Activate Summit. And Victor, I've described Mendeley as a last FM for researchers. Is that an appropriate description? Is that an appropriate box to put it in?
I'd say so, at least for people who know what Last FM does. But I think the similarities indeed extend from the concept to some of the people involved. Concept-wise, you know, Last FM tracks which music you listen to. And we are trying to do a similar thing, but with research. So we have a software which lets people manage research papers and share them. But at the same time, it anonymously tracks what researchers are doing in each field of academia. And then we anonymously aggregate these stats to produce real-time trends about what is happening in each field of research. What are the most read authors, papers, journals, or like Twitter's trending topics lets you find out what people are working on in each field. Also, some of the people who were involved in Last.fm from the beginning, like the first investor and chairman, Stefan Glenzer, he is also our first investor and chairman, actually. And lots of people who worked at Last.fm are now working in our little office. So it's a fair comparison, I think.
It seems to me that things like the search facility is, you know, its direct competitors are very well established academic resources like Web of Knowledge, PubMed. You know, there's a whole variety of Science Direct. You know, there's a whole bunch of existing search facilities for academic research.
Definitely. I think the main use case for now is a different one, which is helping you as an individual researcher be more productive. And the idea came out of myself and my co-founders being PhD students, and all of us had hundreds of PDF documents on our hard drive. And there was always this thing that, oh, you read something in a paper, but you forgot where it was and you couldn't find it. And then you have to write a paper and come up with a citation that you need to format. So it was all very cumbersome. We thought that to be a better way. And the basic idea was that we would write software which would try to automatically extract as much information as possible out of your collection of PDFs and turn them into a structured database for you without you having to enter all of the data manually. And so that is basically what our software does right now. So if you have a collection of PDFs, you can just drag and drop them into the software, and it'll look up additional information from PubMed or Archive, Google Scholar, and structure the information for you so you can search and organize and share with others and read papers and annotate them and share these annotations.
There's a combination between the PDFs that a user has on his or her home computer, which potentially they've already gained access to through, for example, the British Library interlibrary loan searches, or perhaps by downloading it from their own institution's libraries. It then becomes part of your system. How are you dealing with things like the copyright issues? Because, you know, 33 million, 33,000. You've got so many documents and you're freely sharing them between people. And the peer-reviewed journals effectively work off the idea that one person will access it because they've paid one amount of money, or an institution has paid one amount of money. How are you dealing with copyright issues?
Well, I wish we were freely sharing the papers, but we actually aren't. So the way we're dealing with it is that first, the papers are just uploaded into your individual account. So that gives you the ability to access the papers online or synchronize your library across machines. What you can then do is create collaborative groups, kind of like a base camp for researchers, and you invite people into the group. So it's by invitation. And then you can actually share documents. And the most common use case where that happens is within labs, where people have access to the same documents anywhere, anyway. And where people have been sharing for years using email or FTP servers or thumb drives or simply printouts. So academic sharing is a reality, I think. Publishers are aware of that. There's the fair use principle, which says that sharing is fine for nonprofit academic purposes. But also, we've been speaking with all of the publishers right from the start. So some of them actually have been trying to invest in Mendeley, which we thought wasn't necessarily the best idea. Because we wanted to remain independent of that and the publishing business model. But we're not a, I would say, a Napster or file sharing site. And when publishers approach us, they realize that and they actually start to look for ways that they can use Mendeley as a distribution platform.
How do you see Mendeley evolving into potentially an area to distribute content to not only academics, but also to the wider community?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a great quote by Paul Lauterbur, who won the Nobel Prize in medicine. And I think he said, you could write the entire history of science in the past 50 years with papers that have been rejected by Nature and Science. So many people acknowledge that peer review has its flaws, and there are many initiatives that also just try to either do away with peer review completely and very successfully. So, for example, Archive, which is the physics and maths repository, where researchers just upload their papers, and if they're any good, then people will find out after the fact. And the ones that are good will get cited and will get circulated. There are initiatives like F1000, which is mostly for medicine and biotechnology, where you have an army of freelancers who are looking at papers that have been published and then write short reviews of them afterwards and saying, well, this one is an interesting paper, so post-publication peer review. And you can extend that, I think, to working papers as well. So I do think it's an interesting opportunity for people to make their research known by uploading it to Mendeley, and also getting their research included in recommendation or in our recommendation engine. So if you've written a paper that might be interesting to somebody else who's reading similar papers, then maybe your research can get acknowledged without you having to publish it in a journal first.
Well, researchers and laymen and laywomen like myself alike can download Mendeley from Mendeley.com.
The web is an enormously powerful tool for online activists to gather, organize, and collaborate. Charles Leadbeater is the author of We Think, a book that describes how people around the world are using it to fill in the gaps that governments and corporations ignore because they don't have the interest or the finances. A co-founder of the Social Innovation Camp movement and deep thinker about the ethics of cloud computing, I recently spoke with Charles about his book and began by asking him what needs to be in place socially, technologically, or even culturally to ensure social innovation is possible.
The first thing is you have to have capability. I think this notion of capability and openness go together. So if you create open technologies that people can use, adapt, and play with, that builds capability and they almost teach themselves. If you have closed systems where all they can do is kind of use it, download stuff, and go back to the provider, then that doesn't build capability. So the significance of open systems is that they allow people to learn how to use them, adapt their own uses. And so that, I think, is a really important connection. So if you think about mobile phones, the significance of the more open operating systems on mobile phones, which allow people to play with mobile phones and adapt them, that's, I think, of huge significance.
Part of the premise of We Think was this idea of sharing and also recording and devising activists, amateur activists is what you describe them as. Can you tell me a little bit more about these amateur activists?
Well, I mean, I think all over the place what you're seeing are people being able to mobilize forms of knowledge, take action, find other people without necessarily needing high-cost professional networks. So just one example, one tiny, tiny example, but really significant. There's an HIV/AIDS network in Africa called Mothers to Mothers, which is mothers advising other HIV-positive mothers about how to take antiretroviral drugs and how to cope with the stigma of AIDS and HIV in a way that will kind of allow them to kind of live a more normal life. And that is organized, actually a lot of those people use mobile phones and network technology. It's not terribly technology enabled, but it's completely peer-to-peer. It's mothers advising mothers, basically. And what you'll find, I think, in more and more areas is the power of that lateral connection, that actually some of the important knowledge won't come just from a professional, but from someone like me or someone who has a similar experience to mine or someone who's got a vantage point the same as mine. That's becoming more and more possible. And these are new organisational possibilities. We can get things done together, get knowledge, get advice in ways that in the past relied on very big, formal, often professionalized systems.
Commentators like Andrew Keane, who published The Cult of the Amateur, argues that such amateur networks are detrimental to society, ultimately. How would you respond to his contentions?
Well, I think they could be if they become the only way to do things. If they completely displace professional knowledge especially in fields where professional knowledge is needed. And I think there are really important issues for society about things like, how do we fund writing? I mean, if we want to fund serious writing and there's no really good model for paying people to write because publishing is collapsing, then that is, I think, a really significant issue. So I don't think that critique should in any way be dismissed out of hand. But I think generally what it does is it glamorizes and sort of paints a kind of overly rosy picture of a sort of nostalgic past. I mean, Andrew Keen's view of the world is basically that, you know, if the whole world were kind of the Financial Times, the New Yorker and the Guardian, then that would be ideal. But actually, modern mass media, a lot of it is just crap, basically. The reason people don't trust it, don't like it, is it doesn't do a good enough job. So there's a kind of, as well as the cult of the amateur, there is the sort of cult of the professional or the kind of glamorization of that. And the second is that I think it just completely underestimates the sophistication of much of this stuff. That you can go online now and you can find really thoughtful, in-depth, considered, well-informed communities around virtually any issue you like.
There is the potential for organizations, governments, commercial entities to exploit these amateurs. How can we ensure that that doesn't happen? Is it through regulation? Is it through technological barriers? Is it through grassroots organizations? How do we ensure that these amateurs, these valuable organizations and participants in this culture, don't become pawns for what you described as the corporate cloud, you know, the controllers of the corporate entity?
The reason that people use Firefox and open source is that it works. So these open things have to work as well as... They can't just kind of be granola, kind of worthy, well-meaning, kind of all the rest of it. Cooperatives in history that have relied on being seen to be good have not worked and they haven't survived. So one of the first preconditions for this open stuff really kind of surviving is that it works. It does important stuff well. So I think that's a very important precondition. I think the second is that people may well be prepared to buy services like cloud services or from people like Amazon and Apple if they feel in control of them and do a good job. The issues are more about who has the right to control, own, harvest, mine, harness all this information that we're generating, apparently in a kind of free and shared environment, but actually starts getting used by other people for their profit. And there, I think, we'll definitely need an activist kind of amateur culture to say, this is mine, you can't do that. So I think constant challenge of people who attempt to do that. Secondly, I think we will need more effective forms of regulation to understand... You know, I don't think we're anywhere near understanding the difference between regulating an ITV television company and regulating Facebook. I mean, they're completely different sort of challenges. But Facebook may well be our most important intermediary to other forms of information in 10 years' time. And then I think technology is critical as well. And keeping technology open so people can do stuff with it rather than... I mean, the Apple recipe is, we'll give you great stuff, but don't expect to do very much with it. Actually, interestingly, there's a whole bunch of other people, including Google, who I think are much more open in their application, different kind of business model. It's very important that open business models, open ways of doing stuff, whether public, social, or corporate, then survive.
As an aside, which business model do you think is the most successful and will actually work in the future?
Well, I think there'll be a variety, but they'll all have to have at their heart an understanding of how you allow people to share stuff and yet still make money from the fact that they can share stuff. Even Apple allows a sort of limited amount of sharing and a limited amount of kind of collaboration. Computer games, I think they've found a recipe which is quite successful. And Google, I think, is in the open world, but they fund themselves by a kind of monstrous monopolization of advertising around search. And Google will have to share revenue with content creators and other people for the open ecology to work. At the moment, it just simply won't. So I think Google will have to change if it's going to really innovate. And I think all of these people currently look strong, but I don't think Google gets the social web. I don't think Apple gets the open web. I mean, all of them don't get some bit of it. So there's opportunities for other people to come in, hopefully at some stage, to disrupt it, change it, you know, kind of point in different directions.
Charles Leadbeater, author of We Think. You can read more at observer.co.uk/review. That's it for another Tech Weekly podcast. If you'd like to know more about any of these stories, go to guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Now, Jemima, you've got a little wager going here in your head, don't you?
Well, it's nothing weighty, and I think all of us would probably change our answers from one day to the next, but I wanted to know if Apple, Google and Facebook were having a playground fight, who would you put your money on to win?
And we're going to do this in a truly democratic way. We're
paper,
going to
scissors,
say,
stone kind
that's
of
it.
Style.
We're going to say which one we think on three. So ready? One, two, three.
Google.
Oh, right, Victor.
Did we all
you
say
Apple.
Like...
No, I said Google.
No, oh, you said Google.
Said
so what's
Google.
Your reason for Google?
I think they're the nerdiest with the best algorithms.
All right. Robert?
That's my reason for Apple being the winner, because I think Brin, Page, Schmidt and Zuckerberg from Facebook are the playground nerds, and I would not mess with Steve Jobs. You've heard the rumours.
Jemima?
I said Facebook because I think the others are on a little bit of a decline, but also Facebook keeps pushing people and upsetting them, and I think that's really good.
I have the casting vote, and I have to say that I chose Google, and I think it's because they've diversified enough. As little as I like it, as little as I like to admit it, I do think that they've managed to get their do no evil tendrils into as many pies as possible, which could do well for them. But we will not debate this. We will debate this at a later date. Many thanks to our studio guests, Robert Andrews and Victor Hennig. I'm Alex Kratosky. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. And next week, Jemima will be in the bowels of the BBC, digging up our cultural heritage.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.